All right. Well, let me check my level. All right. This is Sarah Milligan, and today's date is December 17th, 2009. I'm here interviewing Allie Lewis Witt Jr. About his experience as a blimp pilot during World War II. So, let's just start. Where did you...
Okay, I'll start at the beginning.
Wherever the beginning might be.
I was a senior at Western Kentucky State Teachers College, it was then. And I had a letter from the draft board. Hitchhike home on Friday, December the 5th.
Where night. Was home?
Francis, Kentucky. Crittenden County, Francis, Kentucky, where Pogue was from. Okay. And I don't remember what I did on Saturday, but I remember what I did on Sunday the 7th.
And what year was that you started to tell me?
I was at home to the draft board. So I was going to ask for 6 months to finish school. I just had a little over a semester to go, spring semester. And they laughed. They said, no, you'll go immediately. My dad said, go see the president of the school. And I did. And he I won't call his name or say what he said. He used a few bad words. And he said, they won't be ready for you. I volunteered for World War I, and we marched with tobacco sticks. We didn't have any guns. We didn't have any uniforms. We didn't forget it. And so I got a letter from the draft board. Provided you graduate at a certain date, you're excused. Okay. A recruiter for V-5 program in the Navy came by in this interim and talked me into coming in flying for the Navy. Now, you couldn't be married, and you had to have at least a bachelor's degree.
Okay.
And so I fit into that, provided I graduated, which I did on time. And so... then I went into the Navy. Now, the Navy, I'll criticize the Army, unlike the Army, sent us to flight school first before they sent us to pre-flight to see that we could fly. So 12 people ended up at Murray State Teachers College. I think there were 4 from St. Louis and 4, maybe 8 from Kentucky. I remember there were 2 lawyers. One fellow dropped out of medical school to go. The rest of us were college graduates to train on light planes to see if we could fly. One of the lawyers washed out. He couldn't fly. See why the Navy did this? The Army never did this, and they should have, because they had a lot of washouts. Well, anyway, from there then, I had 200 or 300. You learn to fly a plane in 8 hours. You can't even teach a kid to drive a car in 8 hours. And then you solo. Now, in the blimp Navy I finally got into, you had to have 100-something hours before you could solo. Well, anyway, we went from there into pre-flight school. I won't go into that. They beat you to death physically. And my room had a roommate from St. Louis, Carl Spitz. I'll call his name, a good buddy. I hope he's still living. And... we said, what about this, I think he mentioned it, what about this lighter-than-air business? And we didn't know much about it. I remember the Hindenburg burning, and I remember the Graf Zeppelin coming over. German, I knew we had lost to Akron and Macon, both of the last ones we had, rigid ships. So we volunteered, and we found out you had to be a third of your class, upper third, to volunteer anything than the routine, see? And so we got busy and both got berths. And my fondest memory of that school, which was the University of Iowa, we had about over 2,000 cadets in the quadrangle there, which I guess doesn't even exist anymore there.
So this was your pre-flight school, was the University
of Iowa? Yeah, this was pre-flight school. And what they did, they conditioned you physically. My fondest remember of that is going down. We had to leave, I think, 2 weeks early to go to our school. And the others would go to with our group kicking each other, playing soccer in a snowstorm as we rode down the hill to get a bus to St. Louis. That's my fondest memory of that. But anyway, we met in Cincinnati and caught a train to New York and down to where everybody trained on the East Coast. Now, there's a training station on the West Coast, too, was Lakehurst, New Jersey. We got a train, I think it was a haul mostly fish down the coast to Lakehurst and put it in there. And so that's where we did our training on L ships, which held about 150,000 cubic feet. That's what we trained on. Now, we did have one old K-2 ship, which was the regular squadron ships, that held nearly 500,000 cubic feet.
Cubic feet?
400 and something thousand, I can't tell you. They were 250 feet long and nearly 100 feet in diameter.
And they held that much air?
They what?
That much air? They held that much air?
No, they held that much gas.
Oh.
Now, we had, see, getting on the side here, the Germans sent the Hindenburg over twice to try to get helium from us. See? And because hydrogen, as you know, mixed with oxygen is sort of bad business. I'll have to tell you this. There's a good Jewish guy there, a lieutenant. Hitler had come to power the first time Hindenburg came over. His name is Weintraub, which is a good Jewish name. Adolf Hitler would have no Jews riding on one of his airships. And so he saw him mark his name out. So he reported the next day, Lieutenant Kelly reporting for Lieutenant Weintraub, and got the ride. Now, he went through as a Commodore. He got up to Commodore as Kelly Weintraub. Going ahead of the business, I was way out to sea one time. He went back to sea because of his rank, and he loved free ballooning. He loved free ballooning, which we had to do. And the light came on, and I told my signalman, see what he wants. And he said, a flotilla of landing craft going south, probably going to the canal to go into the Pacific. We were way out to sea. And he said, I said, ask him what he wants. And he said, be a good day to go on a free balloon flight. And I said, that's Kelly Weintraub. Well, that's going off the story now.
We can come back to that, yeah.
Anyway,
you're in New Jersey now.
Yeah, we went through training. It took about, I'll say first, we're in top physical condition. When we went to flight school, it took us about 2 weeks to get out of that. But you went to school one day, took classes, and next day you flew. And we rotated it, see. And so that was in, we were in a class of 242, I guess. 242, maybe 243. I guess 243 because I got out in 243. We were there about from January to June. Now, once we soloed on these L ships, and it's all in this book. You know, let me just show you this. Now, we signed this book every month. Every month you signed this. All you had to do is write out what you had done. See, and I wasn't smart enough to do that. See, I was a senior pilot there, maybe a command pilot. When it says self, you got your own crew to fly with, 10-man crew. But all you had to do is, you can remember, but when you look at it, I know almost where it's from. This is still out of, I'm sure this is still out of Glencoe, Squadron 15. But you signed it every month, and you could remember what you had done. Was this a single ship? Was this, what trouble did we have? I can't even tell you when both of my engines cut out in a storm, when it was, what flight it was. Well, anyway, I'll go
from the records on your aviator's flight logbook.
Yeah, I'll go on from there. Well, anyway, when we graduated, Admiral Rosendahl was there, the Admiral of the Blimp Navy. He'd come back out of the Pacific, and he gave us a talk, and I only remember two things. He pinned her wings on us. I only remember two things he said. The stern of a ship moves first, whether it's a surface vessel or a flight vessel. Well, I had the tail in the water a time or two, and I remembered that. But the thing he said mostly, you hear people talk about the cruel sea. The sea is not cruel, but she's quick to claim your mistakes. You cocked that in your head. Well, anyway, the ones that had lied and and been married had a mass ceremony on the base. Well, I rushed home and married, and you could volunteer. Well, no, let me go back a little bit. They sent us away to another squadron somewhere, well, some trained at Lakehurst, but I went to Squadron 21, which was below Miami, Florida, for training, advanced training, mm-hmm. where they put you with the squadron ships, see, mm-hmm. and you go on squadron trips, and you see what it's like. And they let us fly, checked us out on several things. I won't go into all that, but then you went back, and we graduated then, and went to squadron. Now, I volunteered, I don't know why, it just sounded good, to Squadron 15, which is in southern Georgia. Brunswick, if you know where Brunswick, Georgia, it's Glencoe is Glen County, and that's why it was named that. Every day when I went to work, I passed under an oak tree where the, if I'll think of his name, and I have trouble with names anymore, wrote The Wonderful Marshes of Glen, the poem. Mm-hmm. And so I flew there most of my flight time. We went on, well, if you're a bomber pilot or any other kind of pilot, heavy in air, you go attack the railroad station, you train a truck, a ship, something. You see what you did. Our job was to keep submarines down. Submarines cannot do damage if you keep them down. In daytime, you can keep them down.
So how did you do that?
Well, they didn't want to come up and get seen. You see, they were doing two valuable things, and we did it with our submarines. They were watching traffic. And this is why we had one base in Massachusetts, and we had, I don't know why, had an attachment on up north. I wouldn't want to even, oh yeah, I've been up there, but I wouldn't want to fly up there. The next one was at Lakehurst, that was 12. The next one was North Carolina, that was 14. We were 15. 21 was at below Miami. Then we went around the Gulf. We used to call it HOMA, it's HUMA. No, we used to call it HUMA, it's HOMA, to guard that side of the Gulf. It went around to Corpus Christi. See, the mouths of both rivers is what we protected because that's where it was coming out. Down the Mississippi, they made submarines that came down the Mississippi and went down through the canal or east one. And so there was, now, on the west coast, well, we went all the way down. Well, the next one was Trinidad, the Rock. Nobody wanted to go there. And then you went, and we all had extras. I remember 21 had a lot of publicity, recently, south of Cuba. I'll think of it in a minute. Ours was at Charleston, South Carolina. One I flew on the West Coast was in Washington. I flew out of mostly out of Tillamook, Oregon. Well, anyway, then all the way down the coast of, I don't know how many we had in Brazil, but all the way down to Argentina. Now, Argentina was pro-German. They hid their ships in there from us. We couldn't get to those. So we couldn't go close to that. So they stopped there. But they were all placed in a way where you guarded, like, Charleston, a lot of stuff went out of Charleston. More went out of New York than anywhere else. I'll come back to that later because I was shipped up there. if I don't run out of time, and I want not, you tell me when it, I'll finish up when the time is up. And so I stayed there, and most of the stuff in here is at Squadron 15, or, as I said, Charleston, South Carolina, and it doesn't separate itself there. Mm-hmm. Now, one time I was up at Charleston standing the duty there. We'd send one ship up there. One would go in there. I had three crews up there, and we'd fly every third day. You flew today, depending on your mission, how far it was to get back. But you had the next day off. The next day you had to report in and loaf around and sleep over that night to fly the next day. Well, anyway, I got off the track here a little bit.
Well, let me ask you something.
Yeah.
When did you go into the military? Do you remember what year it was?
Yeah. I guess it was 42.
Okay.
42. It's after I graduated, which was June or May 1942.
See, okay, right.
I had to go on to 41 if I'd listened to the people at the draft board.
And so when you were talking about earlier that when you read about blimp pilots, you read about piloting, I think you called it an airship, you and your friend, and you, that was a quick jaunt from deciding you wanted to be interested in it to being in New Jersey doing it.
Yeah.
I mean,
well, And anybody could fly a plane. I shouldn't run it now. I'm not sure you could now because all the dudes punch computers. But you could learn to fly a plane in 8 hours. And you've got to think your way in. You see, not only do you take aerostatics, I mean aerodynamics, you take aerostatics. We had more tail surface on our airship than any plane had in the Navy or Army. See? And we were big. We were 250 feet long. And we had two ballonets. You know what a ballonet is?
I don't.
Well, it's a little balloon, German. I'll have to tell you this. The fellow that does one of the programs where they ask questions, somebody said, he asked the question, what is a ballonet in an airship? And they answered properly. But I wondered if he got in his Chevrolet car and drove home. He always looks at him like, you should have known that. Well, anyway, we couldn't get too high. It depends on the... Well, let me give you a test here. On the chart, chemical chart, the lightest thing on there is hydrogen. Mm-hmm. It's one. Now, twice as heavy is helium, is number two.
Okay.
Now, how much more can hydrogen lift than helium? I know what you're going to answer.
I don't know what I'm going to answer.
Okay. Everybody says twice as much. No, there's 15 pounds pressure of atmosphere, so a unit of will be lifted 14 pounds. Now, two will lift 13 pounds, and it makes a difference. Well, the Hindenburg had 7 million cubic feet.
Okay.
Well, we don't have that much, and it didn't make that much. Now, free balloons. We flew hydrogen free balloons. In fact, the free balloon I checked out in, not I, about five other cadets, I'll say I mean other people. When I say I, there are about 10 people in this crew. I had three officers, 7 men. When the crew was after I became a head pilot or a command pilot. I was going to say something about that too.
Well, help me understand what the difference between what a free balloon is compared to...
These noisy things? No, I wouldn't ride. If you asked me what I'd rather do in anything in the world today, I'd say go on a free balloon ride. It was hydrogen. It's an open sleeve over your head. Okay. These things are noisy. You go with the wind. If you smoked, and you wouldn't smoke there, the smoke would stay in your face. we had a roll of toilet paper on there to see if you're going up or down. You roll it out. If it goes up, you're going down. It goes down, you're going up. And you had the drag rope. You could put that out. And if you're a little bit heavy, you go down, and that would take that rope, and you start back up, and you get heavy, and you go down again. You can drag rope for miles if you stay away. Today, it would be nearly impossible with the kind I'm talking about because too many wires. We tried to land in the Princeton football field when I took them.
Is this like a hot air balloon?
Yeah, not a hot air now. But free balloon. Yeah, you could land with a. You could land there now with a other, but they can. You can come down, but well, the pilot was killed on the next, and he's the most blew up. One of my classmates pulled him and the other fellow out, but they were already dead. Killed on the next free balloon flight. Yeah, and it's sort of hazardous, but they did away with it then. They started putting helium. Helium was hard to come by. We used a lot of it. Now, I was talking about these ballonets. You could get as high as that ballonet. Both of them were exhausted. You couldn't go any higher. You'd split open and fall. See, as you go up, less pressure, gas expands, the air comes out of the ballonets, you come down, you put it back in. And that's like, they're not rigids. That's what keeps them, see, the space on them is the pressure. When I lost both engines in over Bull Bay, Bull Island, South Carolina one night, I teased the crew. We'd been way on up north, I guess, toward Hatteras with the crew. We got coming back about midnight, and I sort of teased the crew. I had a very experienced co-pilot, and I said, do you want to walk in tonight or do you want to swim? And they said, we'd rather walk. Well, I had two, so I turned over Bull Island. You had to get over the trees. Been better probably if I stayed in the water and pushed us up so fast that
I think this is interesting. What happened to your engines? Why did they go out?
Well, that was the question. I figured I turned in the report. I had to say that that the atmospheric pressure changed so fast, the carburetors just quit on us. Okay, they didn't like this. Houma, Louisiana, about 2 months later, we're at sea coming in. Now, we turned over the land. They were too far out. Their engines cut, same thing. They went up. Everything fell out, broke the front out of it, just like ours. They got them started, went up again, and they never could get started. One man lived to tell it. They went into the ocean, and these two, I don't know what happened to the others, were holding on to an empty tank, not an empty tank, a gasoline tank, across from each other. This was a young pilot who hadn't got too much out of shape, probably. They stayed on till daylight, and the other fellow said, I've got to give it up. He slipped into the sea, and the other one was picked up. And he reported the same thing I did. We think it was a rapid change of pressure. Well, anyway, let me talk about what we did. You couldn't see what you did. You stayed in front of the convoy or the single ship. Anything below 13 knots, we went into the convoy, escorted. You stayed there with the radar on from daylight till dark. And it kept submarines down, and we only had, one sinking before I went to Squadron 15. I won't call the man's name because he sort of got a bad name over. Was escorting a loaded tanker out of the Gulf for Gettysburg. And they came to line squall, which you would quite often, and they're hard to get through, as I found out. And this other fellow found out it was lost at sea. So he had to go about 25 miles. Now, the ship could go on through it, see, the surface vessel, rough it up a little bit. He had to go about 25 miles around to find a soft spot to get in front. And it's almost dark. And he couldn't pick up his, had a 90-mile radar. You could see 90 miles with it. Couldn't pick it up. And he was confused and returned to base. About dark. When he got to base, he found that S.O. Gettysburg had been torpedoed. Now, that was just before I reported, about a week before I reported in squadron. Now, just before I left that squadron and went north, they said, we haven't had a submarine in the eastern sea frontier now in over 2 weeks. We'll send slow ships through, May or maybe April, I don't remember now, not escorted, not in a convoy. We'll send them through, starting at midnight. Well, two of us had routine flights, and we didn't have any just training flights. It always sends you out training again. And they called us out early. We had a ready room we stayed in, slipping, and called you out. Well, ours about 7 o'clock. We'd go out and fool around and come back in. They called us out early. There had been a sinking in our district just a little after 12. The Germans showed us, we're still out here. And so we had to go out and form a convoy. They sent out a convoy escort, a destroyer out of Charleston, to meet at a rendezvous point. So the first, he had the north sector, I had the south sector. All your, every ship in the district was on a board when you went in, and this is yours, you know, and all of them was there. We had a list of all of them. We didn't find one. I don't think it even existed. But first one I saw was a northbound tanker, and I told a signalman, you had to do all this for lights now. Tell him, change course, rendezvous at longitude and latitude, whatever. Don't have any idea what it was now. And he acknowledged, and now we saw one over here, we picked that up. And there must have been 200 ships in the district, see, we pick up. And so as we came back, he asked, what is the meaning of your message of 0730? And I said, tell him sinking 50 miles north. And the stern of his ship went and he had, but at night, when we left that thing, we had a convoy. Well, you could see from one end of it, there were probably 200 ships in it, and we didn't find one of them. I don't know where it was.
Never. You didn't find one of what?
Yeah,
One of the ships in the convoy?
Well, in the district, in the 5th Naval District. See? And it maybe didn't even exist. But
a submarine, you mean?
No, a ship.
Oh.
Yeah.
So you were sent out to...
get them all together and rendezvous at a point and form a convoy to go on up the coast.
And you didn't find any of the boats in the convoy, for the convoy?
No, we got them all except one.
Oh!
Yeah, all except one. And we didn't ever find that one, wherever it was. Oh. I don't know.
So well, was the main function of blimp, you know, of having blimps to escort... boats?
That's right.
Escort ships.
Ships, and if ever slow moving. Now, anything above 13 knots, a submarine problem. See, a submarine can only do about 2 knots underwater. Now, when they developed a snorkel, it worried us. No snorkel, German. They had a tube that went up and a box up there with a flap on it, supposedly against the sea, and they can't do that, and they could run their diesels. And that would make a little dot. You couldn't pick it out of the sea return on the radar. We were worried about it. It never worked out. When I went into the Navy, we carried 4, 2 in the bay, 2 in the outriggers, TNT charges, depth charges, which you could set at different depths. And you'd arm them and drop them, and it'd go off at that depth. We had 4 of them, 2 on the outriggers, 2 in the bay. And later we got Torpex, which the British developed. You had to be within 15 feet, drop within 15 feet of a submarine to kill it with a TNT. Torpex extended it to about 30 feet. Before I left the Navy, it was 10 miles. We got it from the Germans. They had acoustic torpedoes, and that's like stabbing in the heart. They go to the noise, which is the screws of the ship. And it disables them pretty fast. So one was coming at a ship, and we had a few sailors on these ships with guns, and they were missing it, and it would turn. And that was, keep missing it, keep. And they found out it was following sound, and we got them, and we had them within a few months, acoustic, and that almost did away with submarines. Because they've got to move, and they go to them. Now, we beat this, and they finally quit pulling. They had what they called a foxer on these ships. On a cable, they had something in a box, I never saw it except behind them, that made more noise than the screws of the ship. So the Germans would release one at this boat, this ship, and it would explode on the foxer. You know, the foxer is foxy. And they pull a cable in and let another one out. You want to waste another one on this one, see? So that did away with that. But I say we, planes on the little carriers. I never was in but one squadron that carried these acoustic torpedoes. I think we got one off of, Hatteras, the North Carolina one. They had a submarine that came up and fired on sank a ship in the back of a convoy, and the guy came out with his Y guns on the destroyer, pitching them out, and we had one code group you send out, just four-letter code. You kill the engine, you stop everything, it makes noise. Then you release these two. They were too big to put in the bay, so we had to carry them on the outriggers. And we tried to camouflage them, thinking the Germans think are depth charges, but they're not that stupid. But they wouldn't follow each other. So they stopped everything in this convoy, all auxiliary motors and everything. And they released two. These two, and they didn't follow each other. And there was two explosions about 5 minutes later. Now, the reason they were 10 miles, that's as much fuel as they had. They could only run 10 miles. And that was true of any type of mortar like that in the torpedo. And there was two explosions. Well, the Y-gun man said, we got it. They landed on his deck, and when it got deep enough, they exploded. Well, they exploded at two different times, slightly. So we think we got it, but that's beside the point. Now, I was on one kill. I said these submarines watched. That was part of their job. I was transferred late. We thought the Germans were going to do a Battle of the Bulge on New York Harbor, going to send all the subs they had there. So they put sailing vessels out there, Coast Guard, across from New London around, and we had to fly around the clock. One would fly from daylight till dark, and one dark to daylight, with magnetic gear, and they would get a sound, and they'd send us out on 90 degrees, 70 degrees, whichever, to check it out and see what it was. But we never had that problem with them. But I had the duty, I guess, about just a few days before the war ended in Germany. And a submarine had gotten into New London, where we trained the subs, the people for submarine. And he was in there, and nobody paid any attention to another sub in there, down during the day, but watching the harbor with his person. And the silly guy, he was in 200 feet of water or less, fired on a British freighter coming out of New York Harbor and sank it. So they sent us out. I put up two blimps, and one got a stuck valve and had to come back. But we put 16 rocket charges on it rather than depth charges, because it had to be in shallow water. And they could drop a 16 on him. And they went up there and found him on the bottom and dropped across. Now, to kill a sub, I'll have to be nasty here. You've got to have the testicles of the captain of the sub or his hat. See, this is just what we used to say. You've got to have those two things to prove you've done it. Okay, they sent a diver down, and he could get his big boot through the hole in the submarine. Now, why the guy did it or not, you know, when the war was over, I was in New Jersey. I was shipped up there with several other crews to do this. And back to the old home place where I trained, but I never flew with the squadron there before. So, I don't know. It's just something else. Then I always said I'd like to fly on the West Coast. Well, my wife was pregnant. I left her in Georgia, never to go back, and she finally came up to New Jersey. She was about ready to have a child, which she did there, before I had orders for the West Coast from Moffett Field. We had three places on the West Coast. We had one in Southern California, Moffett Field, which is now, old Moffett was an important man in lighter than aircraft. After World War I, the Germans, that's why we wouldn't give them the gas, the helium. They bombed London so high, now World War I, with those rigid airships, that neither the planes nor the shells, the guns could reach them.
Was that because we gave them helium?
Yeah, that's one reason. We didn't want them to have it, see? You didn't know what they were going to do with it. Well, anyway, I get off the subject here occasionally. But anyway, I went out to the West Coast, and we went to Moffett Field. Oh, I was going to say, Friedrichshafen, Germany is where they did their airships. Okay, the agreement of World War I was that they build three, one for the U.S., one for Britain, one for France. See, we were the Allies in World War. I think we did have the Italians, but if you have the Italians, you always lose. Wish you didn't want them again. Well, anyway, I shouldn't say that about them. But anyway, I don't know what I'm going to say about that.
They had to build one for
three ships. Of us. Okay. Then they were to deliver. Now, you can reclaim, see, and they need to reclaim it because they had to stay. We could get heavier light. Now, if you had your airship out, our blimps outside, you had to figure, see, you had to figure all this out, difference in heavy and air. 700 pounds dew, if it's raining, a ton of rain on the skin of those things. But now the rigids didn't run off, you just pitched them up in the air. They were always, so you can collect, we could have on blimp, but we didn't want it. 115 pounds for every 100 pounds of fuel you burn. So they had these reservoirs on there, on the rigid ships, and they came in to deliver us, ours, and Admiral Moffett wanted to touch it first before it touched down. See, they coming in, they turned their engines, bringing it down. And I think it was just meanness. They said they needed to drop about 1,000 gallon of water, and they dropped it on the Admiral to get even. And then we blew up the factory after they said these two. Well, anyway.
Blew up the German factory.
Okay, we went into Moffett Field, and the war was over with Germany, and I don't know, everything had moved in there, and I talked to my buddy about it. We went over together. We didn't take our crews. We just went alone.
What year did you go to Moffett Field? Do you remember the general year?
It'll be 95. Oh, no, not 95.
45.
I'm getting ahead of things here. Well, anyway, we didn't stay there about 2 weeks. We said, we don't want it here. It's too much crowd. Four officers in the room. You've always been used to one. So we applied for Tillamook, Oregon. It was 33, number 33. And I'm sure glad we did. It got up there, and it was easy duty, and it took us about 2 weeks. I guess it had to go to Washington, come back. We're changing, and we went up there. I think we saw every show in San Francisco and other things, but anyway, we finally got up there, and it was just wonderful duty. I stayed up at Shelton, Washington most of the time, because we're working with the fleet coming in, helping calibrate their, well, we dropping confetti. They, in Puget Sound, they'd come in there and they'd send us out on 270 degree and drop, I say confetti, chopped up metal foil, and they'd take cuts on it, see, to calibrate their, the radar fired their guns. That's what it is.
You got, so you'd drop the metal and they'd use it to calibrate
their
weapons.
Yeah, they would take a cut on it and then they'd calibrate it. Well, anyway, it did mostly there, and it was, I remember I was flying the day the war ended. We had to listen to one, and we usually guarded a fish. If we found a lot of fish at sea, I guess we radioed them where the fish was, and they'd go get them. But I put it on a, I put one on, I knew it was going to, and then I figured the war was going to end that day. And I had one on what we had to listen to and one on a commercial station. And sure enough, it ended there about, I think, about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And I just went on to land, and I told the co-pilots, I said, I just had one co-pilot then, because we'd fly with half crew up there, it was no problem. And I said, I know we're supposed to change, go to Officer Squadron 8, but let's just go in our flight clothes. And they were already drunk. You couldn't get drunk that fast. They'd get up from the table and stagger back, see? Well, anyway.
Well, how long had they been celebrating?
All day, I'm sure, maybe a day before. But anyway, this isn't a POQ. Where do you go? They were going to Seattle. They were going to Portland, Oregon. Tillamook was just west of Portland. I've been back there once. I had a picture in a museum in the city there, along with the rest of the people. That was the greatest thing I'd ever had. I can't tell you this. Anyway, land of cheese, trees, and the ocean breeze over the city, a little town. And they added, venereal disease. They should have, but we used to say, yeah. But it was very interesting there, beautiful country.
Port City.
Oh, a little town. And, I had some pictures they didn't have. They had the whole, it's the greatest thing that ever happened to that little cheese-making city. So I saw your picture in the museum, so I went to the museum. They built a new museum. And I sent them some pictures, which they used and sent back to me. I got an invitation to the museum would open, but I was teaching. I couldn't go all the way to Tillamook, Oregon. But anyway, is our hour up or not?
No, keep going.
Okay. Well, I was eager to get home, and had officers. In the Navy, have to fly. We didn't fly then much. We had flown enough. Lower berth. Now the crew can take an upper berth, but the officers got to have a lower berth. See, and I had to wait for a lower berth. The war was over with Japan. Everything was going east, and I had to wait 2 or 3 weeks to get a. I wanted to get separated in Seattle. Oh, I was going to tell you about celebrating. I went out to the Alderbrook Inn and sat there and listened to a woman play the piano. That was my celebration.
Really?
I didn't want to get in this junk. Well, anyway.
Were you by yourself?
I think somebody else went with me. And we just, two of us went out there. We didn't want to get in that.
Was your wife with you in Oregon?
No. I was getting ready to bring her out there when the war ended. And so I had a daughter then, about 5 months old. I'd only seen one time. And I was eager to get home, and had to wait and get a train out. And lower berth to Chicago. And, you know, once you get across Montana, you're almost in Chicago from the West Coast. And I had to be separated in Memphis, Tennessee, because I joined at St. Louis, and the closest place to St. Louis for separation was Memphis, Tennessee. So I went to, as soon as I got, I ran into the man there that had talked me into joining the Navy.
In Memphis.
He was getting out. I saw him. I remembered his name. He was from Louisville. And I walked up to him. Do you remember me? He didn't. He swore me into the Navy, talked me into getting there. And I told him this, and he said, oh, okay. You're from Kentucky, yeah. And I said, now, we should change places. You get back with me. Oh, no. I'll give you a ride to Louisville tomorrow. And I said, no, I'm going tonight. So, funny thing, I went down to get a train. I'd seen trains in my wife's hometown, but I didn't realize it had backed in there, and I wanted a ticket to Lancaster, Kentucky. I said, the trains don't go there. I've seen them there. Oh, they're back in there. Well, where do they go? Stanford, which is about 10 miles down. So I said, okay, it's Stanford, and I called her, and she met me there. Well, that's sort of the end of it, unless you have some questions about it. I don't know. It's well, you see, we used to say, are we doing any good? Now, we probably save millions of tons of oil and supplies, really. And I'm proud of this book and proud of what we did. When I went to Bard, first time I went to Bard, which was our main route, shipping route, oil, burned oil, and debris floating. Pretty soon that was cleared up. It wasn't there anymore. Oh, they sank the lightship in Savannah Harbor just for the hell of it.
The submarine.
A fellow I went through school with was from New Jersey. Excuse me, I'm coughing. Was on a bar in New Jersey out on the beach, and it came up and torpedoed a ship inside of the beach there, blew him off the stool, and he said, I better get into this war. You know, they just had it going their way till we got organized. Now, we were organized in the Gulf, all the way down the east, up and down the East Coast, and the West Coast. Only one time did a submarine attack. And I met a fellow in Canada fishing one time. There was a gun encampment at the mouth of the Columbia River. That's why we weren't very far away, see. Russian ships I've seen come up the river, Columbia River, and dock and unload or load in Portland, Oregon. And that's why we were there. And a Japanese ship came in one night and was firing on this fort. I can't remember the fort's name. It's just the mouth of on the south side of the mouth of the Columbia River. And I've camped there and in my trailer. He even had a piece of shrapnel. And the man in charge would have let him fire back, said, you'd give away your position. It seemed to me that they had the position if they were lobbing shells over on them.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you what it was like to fly one
a
of
blimp?
These ships. Yeah.
Oh, it's next impossible.
Well, how did tell
okay,
me about
okay,
it.
Okay. You've got a one-arm wheelchair here with a brake on it. Okay, and some people are just too weak to do it. I've come in with blisters on my hand. That's how rough it gets. Over land, it's next to impossible. The steerman is over here. The pilot sits here. The co-pilot's over here steering the course. Takes two to do it.
So you got two seats. The pilot's on the left, the co-pilot's on the right.
Yeah, the one here steering the course. This fellow is really controlled with throttles and everything on this side.
The pilot.
You know, we did something. We had 11 tanks on there, 100-gallon tanks. We carried 1,100 gallons of fuel. You know what we dumped for ballast? We're too heavy? Gasoline. It only costs 3 or 4 cents a gallon. I dumped one time nearly 700 gallon one day. Went out and the radar wouldn't work out of Charleston. And you have to return to base. Radar doesn't work. Got your lifeline. And I had to dump about 300 or 400 gallon to get in. I went out with 1,100 gallon. And so they couldn't repair it there. So we had to send it to home base, which is about nearly 100 nautical miles south. Maybe 70-something. And they started gassing up. Don't gas it up. I got enough. Oh, you don't know what's going to happen. So I had to dump 300 or 400 more gallon down there, and that's hazardous when you dump that stuff. You cut off everything. And well, the Hindenburg, Hitler claimed we sabotaged it. They were waiting out at Barnegat Bay to come in, to land. And there's 6 mortars on those things. Now, I talked about our tail surface is larger than the plane. Their tail surface was half as big as this building. The theory was that they were a little bit heavy, and they valved some hydrogen. And it's very light, as I said, and it got trapped under that fin. And not a fin, it's a lateral one. And when they came in to land, one of the engines torched and caught that and blew the back off. And our old captain, his wife was there with her camera and got it all. She got the whole thing, the burning of the thing. I've been by it many times. It was still behind. The old wreck was still behind the hangar there, number one hangar.
Really?
He hated her the rest of their marriage, I guess. She forgot to put the film in it.
Oh, no.
Dick Andrews.
So did that frighten you? I mean, that was a huge...
No, the old Graf Zeppelin, they tore down during the war for aluminum in Germany. You know, Harry Truman did a lot of things. The only thing against Harry Truman, our admiral, Admiral Rosendahl, got the head man in lighter than air out of Germany to come to this right away. And they designed 2 rigid ships to send around the world and show people. It just cost a few million dollars. Harry Truman vetoed it. That's the only thing I ever had against Harry Truman. Because we had the upper hand, and we should have kept it in that lighter than air. We lost our last 2, the Akron and Macon. Akron was on the east coast, Macon's on the west coast. That's the last 2 we had, rigid. We lost the Shenandoah earlier. We had a fellow at Eastern that used to do... He never did talk, but he's a good researcher for admirals and generals, military people. And I went over to coffee one day, and I said, "Hey, Admiral Rosendahl, free balloon, part of the Shenandoah down, saved a lot of lives. A very important man, general." Oh, he walked by a couple of days. So he's dead. He checked him out. I didn't know the admiral was dead.
Well,
have you cut it off? You still
no.
Well, I'll tell you that Lieutenant Fahey and I were drinking beer. This is when I went back in the bar at Lakehurst, and some lady came in, and our admiral was at Lakehurst. That was his station, and ordered a bottle of scotch, and she signed a chit for it. And Fahey looked over and said, "Rosendahl? You related to Rosendahl?" I said, "He's my husband." "Oh," I said, "tell the admiral we want to see him." Well, an arm came in with braid about up to here and said, "Who wanted to see me here?" And old Fahey said, whoa, "Well, I did. You're going to buy the drinks, you're going to sit there." So he was a good admiral.
So was that after the war had ended?
What?
Was that after
no,
the war?
No. That was when I went back to Lakehurst. No.
Oh, yeah.
We were still flying then. Yeah, it's just...
Well, and I have a question. You mentioned that when you all blasted the submarine in shallow water outside New York, that someone went down to get a trophy. Was that common? Was that normal for someone to go down in the water?
Where most of them sank. You never got a submarine in 100 or 200 feet of water. You've got to go up and down to get away, see? Mm-hmm. What we had...
Did they get the trophy? Did they get something of
his? No. All they did was just check to be sure it was down there.
Oh!
Now, the people might have got off the Germans. They may be, still be digging clams along the coast somewhere. We don't know, see. But nobody got off of it anyway. Yeah.
Huh. Well, how? When did they stop using blimps?
1960-something. I had my son to go by. He was going by the old squadron where I flew so long. Most of that book is there. 15, Brunswick, Georgia. At Brunswick, Georgia. They have torn that base down now. Now, that we had to have two hangars. Doors on each end. It didn't matter which way the wind was blowing, see, then you could always get them in. And they're made out of wood, bolted together, fireproof. They had torn those down, and it took 3 years to haul them away. That's how big they were. They were about, well, 250 foot would go in them, and they were over 100 feet tall, standing, the gondola and all. So they had to be about 200 feet high and about a half a mile long and at least 300 feet wide.
Why did they stop using them?
Well, it took, we had to use 40 men to land them. Now, we were replaced somewhat by helicopters, but helicopters can't stay out 18, 20 hours. And so I don't know. They just, of course, I was probably the first. My name isn't in here. Some senior citizen, some senior pilot was with me. The last flight I had in the Navy, I hadn't. The war was over with Japan, and there's nothing else to do, and I hadn't flown for a while, and you had to. Well, that's not it. Yes, it is. Yes, it is. Well, I thought it was four. Yeah, it's four. Okay, here's the length of flight.
Mm-hmm.
4-2. You had to fly 4 hours to get your flight's pay. That's 70% of your pay. So I came around and said, anybody need the flight skins? And I said, yeah, I haven't flown. And I went over, took an L ship over in Willamette Valley and watched a 7-man football game, and when it came back, when it was over, I went back and waited until surely 4 hours. And right here it says horn. We had a night flying with your gear. If you're searching with your magnetic gear, you had to get down low. You didn't go to get below 200 feet over the ocean. You get the tail in the water right away. At night, that's not good. So we had a klaxon horn. You set it 200 feet. That's the only time I ever called and got the exact setting. There are 40 people out there in a V to collect you. I had forgotten, but I set that on zero. I always wanted to do this. The devil makes you do certain things, you know. And I had forgotten about it, fighting the thing coming in. And that horn went off, and they scattered like everything. And the guy blew his whistle and got an officer and got him back. And nobody said a word to me. I had orders to leave the next day, so it's okay. And they could say anything they wanted to.
So you blew him out of the station.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, the things you want to do that you never get done. But no, it was an interesting thing. You see, it's a fight. It's a fight. We'd have to start 5 miles back, way off. You had to pump properly. I've got a note in here. I never pulled a slip. We had the 10th and 11th Wonder Hunt gallon fuel tank is below. Now there's two toggles up here that you can pull and slip those 200 pounds. You gain 1,400 pounds immediately. Well, we had an amateur who was outranked us all landing, and I was the command pilot, and I guess the guy was too over here steering, and I'm standing behind him. and he kept loading the nose up coming in, pumping in the nose. You don't do that. You're pumping the tail. Okay, there's 40 men out there to get you and a man with the flag. And the nose, it's 100 feet in front of you, 100 feet wide. You can't even see the crew. The nose is rubbing the mat. And I just reached up and got to talk. I said, "Say when, Commander." He's Lieutenant Commander. He said, "You better pull him." But I pull. You don't tell a superior officer you're not doing this right, see? He said, "What'll I do?" And I said, "Give it as much elevator as you can, no throttle." So the nose came up a little bit, and I said, "Advance it very slowly." And he did, and he said, "Now what did I do wrong?" "You pumped in the nose, pumped some." He went back and weighed off again, came in. You've got to think a man. You've got to know what you to work with.
Mm-hmm. When did you get out of the Navy?
When I was about 40-something years old, for the duration. Well, I tried to, when I was in graduate school at the University of Kentucky, I tried to get in the reserves, and they didn't need anybody else. Everybody right after the war, you know, was in. And so I just got busy teaching at Eastern Kentucky University and never did join it. And so I finally got a letter from the Navy Department that said, either get active or get out. Words to that effect. And I said, "I think I'll retire." So I retired. I don't know, I'll be 90 years old my next birthday. I was probably 40-something years old when I really retired from the Navy.
So in the 60s or the 70s?
Yeah, I guess so. I guess 60s probably.
What year were you born?
20.
1920. I was going to say, if you're about to be 90.
Yeah, next birthday. My brother's, 91. He'll be 92 his next birthday. We're trying to, six of us in the family, we're trying to outlive each other. I had the pictures. We visited West Kentucky recently. We went to her mother and dad's grave and had her pictures made. Our daughters, older daughters, the one who's born in New Jersey, made her pictures. And I framed them. And I made two extra frames. And I called Kurt, one in Colorado, and his wife's dead too. And I said, "Now, Kurt, if I should die first, you go out over behind your wife's grave and get your picture made and put on the back of it, frame it, the last wit standing. And in turn, I will do that." I told him this over the telephone. "And I'll go to my wife's grave, National Cemetery, and I'll do the last." So he called me up. And he said, "I'm just going to go and have my picture made. I know I'll outlive you." I called him the other day and thought, well, he'd been having a little trouble, and he didn't answer. He didn't answer. I called and called. He didn't answer. So I called back later, and he answered. And I said, "Well, I was worried about you. I couldn't get you." And he said, "Well, I was taking some cookies out I was baking, and I couldn't run to the telephone until I got the cookies." So he's still with it.
Oh, my goodness. So what did you do after you got done flying your blimp in 1945?
I was going to draw rocking chair money. You heard about General Stilwell came back out of the Orient after about 4 years. He's over in China or Burma someplace. They said, "General, what are you going to do?" "I'm going to sit on the porch in the rocking chair." And they said, he said, "The first year." "Well, what are you going to do after that?" "I'm going to start rocking slowly." So we could draw money for 52 months, see. And I said, "I'll do that." 2 weeks, I was pacing the floor. I went and bought an old used car and took off and got a job as principal school. I said, "I'm not qualified. We'll make you qualified." So I was principal school 1 year, and they called me while I was there, wanting to come to Western teach, and I said, "No, I can't." "Well, you can walk out." "No," I told them, "I'd finish the year." So. And I taught that year, and I told them just 1 year, and I went to graduate school, got another degree, and moved to Eastern and taught there until I retired in 1982.
What were your degrees in?
It was zoology. I was an ornithologist. What do you call that bird?
An eagle?
What kind of eagle?
Bald eagle.
Oh, that's bald. The name is leucocephalus. Now, if there's anything that irritates me, it's that. I got the name the other day from a bald cypress, the Latin word for bald. I don't know. Now, the white head, leucocephalic is head. Now, it also has a white tail. Now, the Latin for tail is urus. What if they had named it leucourus? Would you say, there goes a bald-tailed eagle? No, you wouldn't say that. I did snakes and, well, primarily embryology and anatomy was my field, but my hobby was snakes and birds. I wrote one bird book, and I wrote one snake book. But anyway.
What'd your parents do?
Oh, my dad worked for U.S. Steel Company and was sort of a do-anything, practically. My hobby for years, and his was too, is wood. I should have brought you something that I'd made.
It's nice to look at, though.
Yeah, I make these.
That's great.
You saw one with a buddy there. I gave him one recently. So I got them all over. I got some in Michigan, every place. I give them to people.
Well, we've done an hour, but I'm telling you, there's a lot of stuff that we probably could have talked about a lot longer.
Well, I didn't say as much about this as probably I should, but I hope I got the point across that people thought, okay, a friend of mine was shot down on a 24 trying to do 25 missions so he could rotate home. We're good friends. He died a couple of years ago, year and a half ago maybe. And I said, you were trying to get 20. He was in a prisoner of war for a year or two. And he had a rough time, I know. And he shoot it out. And he was flying with a strange group that didn't know who he was. Of course, the Germans knew everybody on everything. And he was a young kid trying to get home, flying with a strange crew. And they wouldn't let him associate with others. They put him over here. They thought he knew something. Here he was, a young, probably 18, 19-year-old kid. But I said, man, I had 109. They weren't shooting at you. And I said, no, we wouldn't have been doing a job if they'd been shooting at us, because we kept them out of the way.
So he got shot because a submarine came up and shot?
No. He was a B-24 out of England, over Germany. Oh. Yeah. No. No, I had a... Well, we all... the only one I know was shot down, one of my buddies, well, one of my classmates. They were down about tail end buoy one night. Now, tail end buoy is a buoy I fished down there recent year where you go into the Gulf of Mexico. Now, the submarine tried to get into the Gulf. They could do damage in there and find out a lot. And they'd been trying all day to get in there. Well, the current coming out of there is about 2 knots. And they caught them about midnight on the top. And they probably couldn't dive. They probably didn't have enough energy to dive, to crash dive. They could open and sink, but they couldn't get their charges to go. They went and made 2 passes over them. And a blimp, you don't go down there and turn around. You go about 2 miles down there and come back. And so they opened fire and set one of their engines on fire, and they had to... they had to put it in the ocean. And they lost the one guy. They picked all the rest of them up, 9 or 10 of them up the next day, or 11, whatever they had. One got sick, and they all moved away from him. He was vomiting. you try to get away from that. And he came up, went down, came up and yelled, sharks, and they saw some blood and went down and never came up again. Others stayed together and were picked up that morning. And my classmate was one of them that was picked up.
What about when you went down? You talked about it was strange that you went down. you know, because you had the, you hit the altitude and it dropped you, like the case in Louisiana. Yeah. But what? Tell me about the experience of that.
Well, you're lucky. You mean coming down in an aircraft?
Yeah, like an emergency landing. Like when you came down and you asked them, do you want to swim or do you want to walk home?
Oh yeah, well no, that was a. Well, nobody went out. Somebody had opened a gallon of pears back in the galley. The most I remember about that is pear juice all over. You were like this, see? And everything broke out the front, plexiglass, everything. Bombardier's area. Now, the machine gun was up above us. It didn't bother that. But stuff coming through, so everything loose went out.
Because your nose was going straight down.
Oh, yeah. And... So we went up tail first. Well, one of the engineers was sitting back in an easy chair, which is back there. We had one bed that pulled down. And he grabbed the leg and got the engine started. See, the pilot couldn't start the engine. The engineer had to start it. And got one started and then the other. We got the pressure back and then we got control of the thing. See, no control. You could just spin the wheel and nothing happened. There's cables, 100-foot cables that went back to the tail to steer it, and they were just loose. They wouldn't do anything to tighten it back up.
So you didn't actually crash.
No, we didn't. We would have crashed in the trees. We didn't even get down to 100-foot trees. We were right over the top of them when we went up. I imagine 2,000 feet. I remember a co-pilot said, "What are you going to do?" And I said, "There's nothing we can do." I did say a little prayer.
So it was because the engineer.
Well, that's right. He was a good engineer. I had to get rid of some people. I had one radarman one time. I got suspicious of him. He'd sit there, wouldn't move. And I got turn up the PPI brilliance, and he didn't move. He was sound asleep. And he's supposed to be watching for subs behind us, front of us. So I got rid of him. I had one, the top man in our class in New Jersey. He was real skilled at all the tests we took. I didn't know how he could fly, who his instructor was. I was a senior pilot, and he was still a junior pilot and was in my crew. So I said to him one morning, I forgot his name now, I said, ready the ship this morning. You had to check everything, and I'll sign the pink sheet. You know, I was going to be, you see somebody here, I may be running it, but somebody outranks me had signed the pink sheet. And he said, "I'd rather not." And I said, "I'd rather not have you in my crew. So when we land today, you go to the flight officer and tell him you want to change crews." I don't know if whatever happened to him, he changed and I got another one. When you're flying, they'll do anything to you. This is, you don't need to go anywhere or do anything. One time they signed me to take care of the fella that made our coffee and made our bunks in the ready room, black guy. Real funny guy. His wife worked in a, and he had to be there at 8 o'clock and have coffee made for the officers, and had to make up the bunks from the night before. That was no problem. What was his name? I don't remember his name now, but some of the officers complained, "He isn't coming in making a coffee." Well, he lived with his wife in town. He was the only sailor there that had liberty every night of the, so I said, "Oscar," whatever his name was, "you've been coming in late." "Yeah, what's been happening?" "I've been missing the bus." And I said, "Okay, you're the only sailor in this squadron that gets to live with your wife. Now, the next time you miss the bus, you're going to spend 2 weeks on the base, not get off of it." "Yes, sir." Well, a few days, I had a telephone call. "This is Oscar," whatever his name was. "Where are you?" I hadn't even missed it. It was about 8:30, 9 o'clock. I said, "I'm still in Brunswick." I said, "What happened?" He said, "The bus missed me." And I said, come on in as quick as you can. He had me. He didn't miss the bus. The bus missed me. Okay, come on in as quick as you can. And I explained to him that the next time that the bus missed him, you might be. But he was a good one. Honest. Somebody accused him of stealing. And I said, he's lazy. He's no good. But I don't think he steals. Some officer flying left his billfold, some money, under the pillow. And he brought it to me and gave it to me. And I said, I think he's honest. He's no good, but he's honest. Well, I like to talk about this. I've talked to a lot of people about it. If only, self. Wonder what I did there. I counted these, and one time, and everything, I think 8 hours, I counted a mission. Now, this is not my writing. This is my young kids.
You can tell.
They used to get this book, and they have a hard time finding anything in it anymore. Say he.
How many hours did you fly total?
I was going to get here and read it to you. And not as many as some of them. 1,881.9. Approximately 9 hours of flight. 194 squadron flights, that is mission. 22 training flights, total of 216 flights. Now, all I had to do, I remembered this one, that was the last one, but was just put on here what I did, what happened here, and I'd had something.
Just in your log, other than you just put the basics in your log book.
Here's a captain, signed it. He's a good captain. We had to sign this every month, see?
Mm-hmm.
And all you had to do, this is all my, where it says self, I had the control of the thing. Mm-hmm. Here's the number of the ship.
And the type and the date.
ZP, for blimps. It was when I first went in, it was lighter than aircraft, then they changed that to blimps. Is that Andrews?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. He's the guy that didn't like his wife after she left left the film out of the camera.
Do you miss it?
Do what?
Do you miss flying blimps?
Oh, like you miss a sore thumb. It got old.
Yeah.
See, when I was on the West Coast, it was boring. I'd go up. We'd go out to a place, the Alderbrook Inn. When I went out there a few years ago, went out to old Alderbrook Inn. It had been torn down, two old maids around it, just jewels, and something new. But we used to, I'd go up there and fly, and we'd come in, a little bunch of kids there. It was a vacation place, families there. One little boy had glasses about this thick, and he was picked for the last of everything. We'd fly over and drop notes to one of the kids. Now, you're going to do one. You'd cut one, the starboard engine, go back, take a Dixie cup, put some sand in it, write a note, put a name in it, and throw it down. They'd give it to the right person. And this little kid was just, you know, he was never picked anything, and lived around the sound someplace there. And I wrote his name on one, put it down. I had a letter from his mother after I got out of the Navy. I don't know where she got my address. I was teaching someplace, and said, you made his summer. He was accepted after he got a note. Went back out there in 1975, I guess, and stayed in the state park. I was with my Airstream and picked up, we used to go pick up on a beach oysters, all you wanted. And they had limited them then to six, and you're supposed to shuck them there. Went around to State Park to register, and I told a guy who used to fly here and used to, he called his wife, said she was one of those. And I said, did you get a note? And she said, yes. And I said, wasn't my name. And she said, I can't remember whose name was in it. But we just throw those to kids. Okay.
Cool.
We had a tube we used with a funnel on it, And we had a potty. No flush. Big brown paper bags. Threw them out to the shark. But anyway, the food that was left, the crew would always take. And we called it brown bagging. So, on the fresh bags now. And anyway, flying up there, we flew with half a crew. Now, they always put on 10 one-pound steaks for lunch with butter to cook it in and so on and so on. What peas and carrots and always had pears. Well, the cooker didn't work. And I had 10 steaks. Now, I was skipper on the head man. And I called up the chief and I said, put the steaks and the butter in a brown bag. I'm brown bagging today. I want all those steaks. Nobody touch them. They're mine. And I flew over this place where the people were. They had been on the East Coast, same place I love to go, and the West Coast is out there, paper mill business. And I said, I flew over and wrote a note. I've got 10 one-pound steaks. This wasn't a kid. This is a man with a little girl that used to write, just follow us around and write to us. I'm sure she had a note. And I'll be back in 45 minutes or whatever, have the grill hot. Well, they had, of course, you were too young to remember, but you had accumulate a lot of money to get a steak, some kind of stamps to get a steak. After that, we could have their car, their boat, anything they had.
I'm sure.
Well, I've enjoyed it, really. I've really enjoyed it. And maybe I should have more information on it. But
you can come back anytime, well, and we can fill in stuff. Jim's coming back in January if you want to come back with him.
It's glad to be to Milliken.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, the Millikens were all bald-headed. Now, I'm a wit, but I'm a half. Well, no, they say, are you a half-wit? And I say, how can I? I said, that's wit, W-I-T-T. And I said, we didn't do that in our family. The only way I could be a half-wit is my daddy bred his sister. And it embarrasses him. And I say, we've got an H in our name. Now, we haven't had the H knocked out of us yet. We should have, but we haven't had it. And it sort of embarrasses him. But see, I'm a quarter wit, a quarter Milliken, a quarter Moore, and a quarter Ashbridge. So how do you get a half wit out of that?
Oh.
And my wife had another name.
Well, Western Kentucky, there's a lot of ways to spell that out there.
Well, the Millikens are bald. We went to visit a great uncle. I was thinking about it. My brother was there, who's one still living, one time at our place, and I was going down to University of Tennessee. I was thinking about going down working on my doctorate at the university. I had to be there at 8 or 10 o'clock in the morning. Now, you can't get from Richmond on the old road down there, so we went on Friday. And there we said, we got a great uncle here that runs my grandfather's brother that runs a grocery store downtown, a little some country grocery almost downtown, which they used to have, and the pop and mom store. Said, let's go see him in the morning. And so we went in. And my brother said, I wouldn't have said it to him, I guess, but my brother, he was down doing something, said, you don't know us, do you? He looked up, said, no, but I know those heads in hell, you're about to be Millikens. And so I went to one of my uncle's funerals out in Cape Girardeau, Missouri, and his nephew was there. His dad was already dead, and he was balder than I am, and he's probably 10, 15 years younger than I am. And he said, I know you. And I said, I wouldn't know you if you didn't have that old Billiken head on you.
Oh, it's amazing with family.
Well,
like that.
It's been a pleasure. I enjoyed it. And I'll tell, your first name's Sarah.
That's right.
I'll tell Bill I saw you. He said that some of the people may know me over there.
Me. That's me.
Yeah.
Yeah. I just sent him a Christmas card.
I worked for him once. I took West Kentucky. One of my Milliken friends lived over there. She had married, but she was a Milliken, Uncle Jess's daughter. And Cairo, I started called her and she wasn't there. She may still be living. Last time I called her, I couldn't. These things, it's hard to hear over telephone. And had the northern part of the state all the way through Louisville. I guess up as far as, where did I stop off? I had to go back to work finally. So I dropped off. Another team took the other spot. I did the, most of the time I was doing the superintendent's school.
Yeah.
They were doing the, Bill had an idea, Bill, the power structure of Kentucky, three people are responsible for it. The judge, the county judge, superintendent of schools, and it was a family-owned newspaper now, you know, and it's no longer the county judge, it's executive, it's all changed. But I did nearly every place I went, except maybe Owensboro and Louisville, the school superintendent had more money to spend than anything else. See? And the county judge had money to spend. And the newspaper, the county-owned newspapers, or city-owned newspapers, sort of controlled the thing, you know. Yeah. So it was a very interesting thing. And
well, it is. Well, tell Bill that I said hi.
Will do.
And if you want to come back, I'm ready for you whenever.
Well, if I come back, I'll bring Bill.
That'd be all right. I'm going to go ahead and stop this.
Interview old Bill.